Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast of Connecting Faith. Programs like this are made possible through the financial support of listeners like you. You can find out more or make a gift by clicking on the Support Faith Radio tab on the homepage. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hey, thanks for taking some time out of your lunch hour to join me today on Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. I always appreciate the opportunity to interact and reflect. And today be a great day to hear from all the guys listening that are taking a little lunch break or just maybe moving around in a vehicle or listening at work or at home, where it might be. So we're going to talk about achieving high-performance friendship. And this is particularly for men, how we can develop strong friends, become a bond of brothers, a band of brothers, and we'll talk about that. Matt Reynolds, my producer. Matt, you have a good, close male friends?
We're working on that.
Are you? Okay. All right. Well, yeah, Ted, besides Ted Ross, of course. Yes. Ted's everybody's friend, and, well, we're going to talk a little about it. Just, you know, evaluating, wondering, you know, who do I have in my life that I would label as close friends, and what does that look like? In fact, we'll ask our guests, you know, what's the difference between, you know, friends, associates, and close friends. But let's welcome the gentleman to our broadcast. Dr. John Vodder has been a friend for a number of years, and he pastored in Minnesota and Arizona, as past president of both Western Seminary and Phoenix Seminary. Before that, served as a Northwest Regional Director for Campus Crusade. And he, maybe you know him, have heard him on the air with the radio broadcast, You're Not Alone. In fact, he started that. He and his wife, Susan, founded You're Not Alone after their families invaded by drug abuse. Written a couple of books on common graces and hit by a ton of bricks. And he has co-written a new book with his good friend, Dr. James Weatherby. And Jim Weatherby is internationally known speaker, author, and leading authority on the use of computers and information systems to improve organizational performance and competitiveness. And Dr. Weatherby serves as the Stevenson Chair of Information Technology and Executive Director of the Institute for Internet Buyer Behavior at Texas Tech University. He also taught at the University of Memphis and was at the University of Minnesota for a number of years and the University of Houston as well. And he's written Jim, is it what, 18 books, 30 books? It's a number of books, right?
32, but who's counting?
Okay, 32, yes. And John is not counting because it's not really even a contest or a race. But John, welcome. Good to have you on with us again.
Thank you. I haven't even written 32-term papers, so I'm not in Jim's league.
We're glad to have you guys on. And we want to talk about the book is called Achieving High Performance Friendship, a book for men. It's just out. In fact, we have four copies that we're going to give away. So I want to just encourage you as you listen to our discussion to be ready to jump in and join the conversation. And we'll make sure that if you're one of the first of four, that you can have a copy of the book. But guys, let's talk a little bit about, obviously different backgrounds, business professor and the speaker and the pastor and, seminary leader. We want to talk about how you guys got together in terms of friendship. But let's define what do we mean by high-performance friendship? And maybe before that, what is a close friend or, you know, versus an acquaintance?
Well, Neil, the metaphor that we use in the book is, if you're going down the highway and you have to pass an 18-wheeler, you sure like that performance from your engine to get you around that 18-wheeler in a hurry. And so similarly, when you want to call upon a friend for support, whether it be physical, emotional, psychological, or spiritual, we certainly don't want an anemic, sluggish response. We want someone that really is there for us. And so that's kind of the idea of the high performance in the book.
And, Neil, I would add one thing to that as well, and obviously the people remain anonymous, but a friend of mine told me that his father-in-law has golfed with the same three men for, I think, 14 years. One of the men was divorced 3 years before he told these three men that he golfs with every week. So obviously even though they would use the word friend, they weren't friends because they didn't rely on one another, they didn't share with one another, and they didn't tell each other what was going on in their lives. So Jim and I would say that even though we use the term friend in our country to describe that relationship, it's not really friendship. It's not a high-performance friendship.
Well, I guess I want to maybe pick up more on the idea of sort of not a sluggish response, because that, to me, sort of feels different than sharing or, I don't know, just maybe define that a little bit more. I mean, that, not a sluggish response means that your friends are there at the drop of a hat whenever you need them. I guess that's kind of what I think of is, but there's more to it than that.
Well, there's more to that, and a year or so ago, I was thinking of buying a car and here in Arizona and talked to the salesman, and then someone else called me and changed the price. And I said to him, either you were lying to me or you don't know what you're talking about. Which is it? And he said, have a nice day, and hung up on me. So I called Jim because I didn't know if my attitude was bad or if my attitude was right or if I should call the man to apologize. And I knew that Jim wouldn't just placate me, but he would tell me the truth. And he did. And so Jim and I would call that high-performance friendship. That I could rely on him not just to make me feel good, but he would look me in the eye even though we were on the telephone and tell me the truth.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the importance of honesty and truth-telling, as well as some other key characteristics or traits. But let's go back and talk a little bit about your relationship, how that developed, because a lot of us have friends. I was just telling you, John, the phone here just a few minutes ago. It's like, well, I've lots of acquaintances, but, I guess the question is, should I be able to list on, should I know right away who my high-performance friends are? And, if I don't have them, can I get them? And did you when you guys started out in relationship, was there an obvious point where you said, this is going to go farther and deeper than some of my other acquaintances?
Well, we better let Jim talk first because he was avoiding me for a long time, and it's sort of humorous as to why he was. So you want to go, Jim?
I'm a strong-willed, spiritually challenged person, and things as academia is full of a lot of atheists because of the delusion of intelligence and the kind of higher standard for coming to conclusions. And my mother was a dear woman, and faith came so easily to her that often the type of person she would like as a pastor wouldn't appeal to me because they were a little bit clouds in the sky. And I had actually brought her and my father up to Minnesota when I joined the University of Minnesota faculty, and they were real impressed with John. And I didn't want to go to church because I figured I'd be disappointed and then it would be awkward. But to my mother's credit, in this case, she was really looking at a pastor that fit my need because John was just a very rigorous, structured, logical thinker. And when he got from A to B to C, he always did so with good logic and built the foundation. And so I eventually visited the church, and I was just very impressed with John and saw in him someone who could have very easily been a businessman if he wanted to. He was not just kind of a, clouds in the sky type of pastor. And so as I interacted with him, I became more and more impressed with the way he thought about things, the way he arrived at his faith. And I actually ended up making a proposition. I wanted to go to Israel, which is kind of the corporate headquarters for all the three big religions. And I offered to pay his way if he would be my tutor and answer any question I wanted to ask him with the same directness and integrity that I saw him use from the pulpit. And during that trip, we really bonded. And John kept his word. And when he wasn't certain of something, he admitted it. And when he knew something, he was a great tutor for me. So that really was kind of, I think, the defining point where our friendship really went to the next level.
Yes, Neil, but for me, that something is in between there, and it's really my story more than Jim's, and that is that when I was 15, a man in our neighborhood, and it's a long story that I won't tell here, but we tell it in the book, a man propositioned me sexually, and he was the the uncle of my best friend and that sort of thing. And I never told anyone that until I was 29 years old. I was already married, already a father, but always that had put doubt in my mind about did I look effeminate or something. And then at Wayzata Free Church, I told the story one day to talk about attitudes that I needed to learn to forgive that man, even though I was an innocent victim. And Jim came up after the sermon and said, "That man sexually abused you." And I said, "No, he didn't. He didn't touch me." And Jim said, "No, he abused you." And I said, "No, he didn't. Yes, you did. Yes, he did." So we were sort of like two junior high boys there. "No, he didn't. Yes, he did." And that really impressed me because Jim said, sexual abuse does not mean you get touched. Just being approached and propositioned is sexual abuse. And I realized that Jim really cared for me, even though by that time I was his pastor, and that he was willing to hold firm when he knew he was right. So for me, that took the relationship beyond the pastor-parishioner relationship that I began to understand that day, standing there in the front of the church, I could really trust this man, and that's when I began to reach out to him.
Well, John, let me ask you, should pastors have close friends? Because I know seminaries have been saying otherwise, right?
Well, I don't want to say seminaries have been saying otherwise. I would say some professors say otherwise. In fact, and I won't tell you which seminary it is because I've been a student at three seminaries, but the preaching professor at one of the seminaries I attended would say to pastors-to-be, do not be friends with anyone in your church. And the first time I heard it, I thought it was wrong. Thought it was wrong 10 years later and still think it's wrong. I think pastors have to be careful, and there certainly has to be a great sense of trust there. And if a pastor tells someone in the church, a friend in the church, something confidential about what's going on in his life or in the life of his family, it has to be held in confidence. But most of the guys I run with say, if I didn't have friends in the church, where would I turn when I'm under pressure? As I did with Jim that day when I called after I had that little verbal altercation with the car salesman. I needed a friend to tell me whether or not I was wrong or right, whether I was sane or insane. So I definitely think pastors need to develop friendships in the church.
Jim, John, I'll let you follow up as well. Do men want close friends, and how are our friendships different from a woman's?
Well, if I can just add just a thought to John's comment there, and then I'd be happy to respond to that, Neil, is that the danger of when you're a pastor or you're a professor or you're a boss or you have any type of sort of status is that you can get adulation. When someone becomes a boss, they find that their ideas are more readily accepted, their jokes are funnier, and everything seems to be working better for them. And what they tend to lose is the person who would challenge them on something. And, in fact, we talk about litmus tests in the books. And if you have a friend and that friend never challenges you ever in a constructive way, then you have to question, is the friend comfortable criticizing me? Because all of us know we are not above criticism or suggestions for improvement. And if we want that from friends and we never get it, then we would say that's not a high-performance friendship. And John and I have known each other for 30 years, and we have both constructively criticized each other. We've never had hard feelings. We've never had an argument. But we have said things to each other that some people would get very defensive and react in an angry manner. So if you're going to be a pastor and all you're going to do is listen to the people that love and admire you, if you're a professor and you do the same thing, or you're a boss and you do the same thing, you're really running the risk of not having integrity in those relationships.
Well, let me tell you what. Let's take a short break, and we'll come back, and we'll pick up on that question. Do men want good friends or close friends? And we'll hear more from our guest today, Dr. John Vodder, who is a conference speaker, and he's authored several books. He's been a pastor in Minnesota and in Arizona, president of both Western Seminary and Phoenix Seminary in the past. And he and his wife founded You're Not Alone, the ministry that helps families, particularly families in ministry with kids involved in drugs. And Jim Weatherby, Dr. James Weatherby, is a is the Chair of Information Technology and Executive Director of the Institute for Internet Buyer Behavior at Texas Tech University. He's a professor and author and speaker, and he is both have co-written a new book called Achieving High Performance Friendship, a book for men. We're going to talk more about it in just a minute and also take your calls. So let me give the phone number out if you want to queue up, and we'll get to you here shortly. It's 877-93-FAITH. It's 1-877-933-2484. Back in a minute. It seemed like if we're going to do a program on Friends for Men, that we'd be playing something less, I don't know why I was going to say insipid, but it's not an insipid song. It's just, I don't know. So it's fine. It's fine, man.
It's hard to find any songs that are geared towards men that talk about friendship.
All right. You're right. Well, we're talking about achieving high-performance friendship. And with us today, John Vodder and Jim Weatherby. Guys have been lifelong friends and have written a book together about achieving high-performance friendship. So let me ask you, Jim, right before the break, we're talking about do men want close friends and how is that different from women?
Sure. Well, and that's actually one of the motivations for writing the book. There's been a lot of research shown that men are hesitant and cautious about really opening up to other men. I can't imagine my life without the close friends that I've had, and I treasure people like John in my life because, my gosh, they've helped me avoid so many mistakes, and they've made me aware of things that I were doing that were not in my best interest as a man, as a Christian, to help me grow. And so we have talked to a lot of men when they have looked through the book and said, you know, I don't have friends like that, and I sure would like them. And we've also have had a lot of women look at this, and they say, this describes my husband. He is so lonely. He does not have a close friend. And we've talked to men that have been on their deathbed that look back at their life, and they just feel a void in that area of deep friendship. And it certainly wasn't the example Christ set for us. He had his close friends. So the research shows that men do need it, but in our society, we've gotten so casual about it. Even social media, you can just click a button and become somebody's, quote, friend, unquote, and it just doesn't have the deep meaning. Where women, on the other hand, tend to demonstrate a more quick willingness. I even watch my wife, how quick women would just open up and share fairly intimate things with each other with great comfort that men would not be so quick to do.
John, how about with you and Susan? I mean, what's the differences in your maybe levels of friendships?
Well, could I just go back to what
Sure.
Jim said for just a moment? Because I think our culture also mitigates against deeper friendships, and it's not a story we tell in the book, but years ago when I was still with Campus Crusade for Christ, I was up in Spokane, Washington, and I happened to go to the gym to work out with two friends who had been college basketball coaches, and there was a little kid, he was about 4 or 5, apparently his mother would go play racquetball and let him run wild around the gym, and so the two coaches were at one end shooting baskets, and I was down with this little kid, and he threw the ball up, and it hit the rim and came right back and hit him in the face. Must have hurt terribly. He was crying, and I picked him up and was patting him on the back, and I said, that's okay, that's okay. Big boys don't cry. And when we got to the locker room, one of my friends turned to me, and he said, with a lot of firmness, the kind of friendship Jim was talking about earlier, he said, who told you big boys don't cry? He said, that little boy was hurt, and you were denying him the right to hurt. Who told you that? It was really a poke in the eye, and I got thinking about it and realized a lot of it was just our culture that somehow we men have been taught not to tell the truth. So that's what Jim and I are trying to say, is that in genuine friendships, in achieving high-performance friendships, we have to tell the truth to one another, and when we hurt, we have to be honest to say that you didn't do a good job there, or yes, you did do a good job. So excuse me for avoiding your question for just a moment, but I wanted to add that because I think it's a cultural thing. And interestingly enough, I was just asked the other day if I might go overseas to speak for a mission organization because I gave the mission executive a copy of the book and he read it. And I said, are you telling me that this is a problem in Latin America and Asia as well? And he said, of course that's what I'm telling you. It's not just an American problem. So maybe it goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. I don't know. As it relates to Susan and me, to your question now, Neil, I think Jim expressed it exactly correct. I'll find that Susan and I'll meet a couple, and I'm sort of dancing with a guy. We're sort of like gorillas in the jungle, you know, seeing who can top one another, and Susan and the woman are already sharing fairly honestly about, you know, being 67 years old and grandkids, and meanwhile, the man and I are still sort of pushing each other away from one another. So maybe it's in our genes. I don't know.
Which brings up, I guess, you know, we've mentioned the word honesty several times, and I know as you talk about some of the key traits of a high performance friendship, the first, you know, two that you talk about is humility and honesty. And we've got a break coming up in a couple of minutes, but let's just jump in with honesty. Why is, I mean, I guess that should be the foundation of any friendship, whether it's men, women, boys and girls, or anything.
Yeah, well, when we started the book, I was working on the acronym FRIENDSHIP, seeing if we could pull chapters out of those letters. And Jim said to me, you know, you were always talking about being Christ-like, so let's see if we can use that term as an acronym. And so then, through Jim's leadership, we began to say, can Christ be our example in each of these points? And so we first looked at the life of Christ with his friends and realized that he was always honest. With Peter, he said, get behind me, Satan. You don't have the agenda of God in mind. You have your own agenda in mind. And yet when Thomas was doubting, he didn't berate him for that. He held out his hand. He said, Thomas, put your hands and your fingers in my scars here. So Jesus was always honest. And so Jim and I just picked up on that then and began to say, then high-performance friendships are friendships of honesty.
Well, and we actually ended up with that Christ-like and used that as a framework for our chapters. You know, we have honesty in that chapter. We also have humility. Christ washed his disciples' feet and really set an incredible example for us in terms of being willing to do, low-level, servant-level gestures as part of friendship. In fact, if you think about it, as error-laden as we are in our lives, if you're going to be honest, you got to be humble because we all just, you know, we try to live Christ-like lives, but we're going to fall short all the time. And so the only way to be honest is to be humble about that.
You know, I always think that, you know, you talk about the humility of doing for others, but it seems like we want, we want a relationship that has equality, right? So that you're not always doing something for me or I'm not always doing something for you. We just have a minute to maybe start on that. What do you think?
Well, we actually talk about the concept of a mirror. You've probably noticed when you're most thoughtful of other people, they're thoughtful back. And when you're gracious to people, they're gracious. If you try to outdo them with bragging about your accomplishments, you're going to bring out that behavior. So it's not about belittling yourself. It's about showing that humility. And what we find, and we give plenty of examples in the book, and certainly Christ set that example, is that, generosity and thoughtfulness begets the same thing back. It's just like a mirror.
We're coming up to break, and we'll continue. And we want to invite you to join the conversation, and guys particularly, if there's some thoughts about friendship, or maybe wives, mothers, sisters, you're wondering about how can you encourage your family member to develop and invest in high-performance friendships. We'll hear more from Dr. John Vodder and Dr. James Weatherby here in just a moment. We've got some copies of the book. We'll be happy to give away as well. For those that join the broadcast, it's 877-93-FAITH. It's 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. Press 1 to join us on the broadcast. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Once again, Mr. Reynolds, you've exceeded standards. So,
I don't know what to do. Sure. Vitamin C is the best I could come
see,
up with.
If we could get some Tim Allen going, that would probably be just fine. Anyway, we're talking. It's a program for guys, and talking about guys today. We're talking about Achieving High Performance Friendship, a book for men. That's the title of a new work from co-authors Dr. John Vodder and Dr. James Weatherby. Dr. Weatherby is on staff at Texas Tech University, professor there. He's been a professor at the University of Memphis and the University of Minnesota and the University of Houston. He's authored some 30-plus books, internationally known speaker, leading authority on the use of computers and information systems to improve organizational performance and competitiveness. And he's teamed up with his good friend of many years, Dr. John Vodder. John has pastored in Minnesota and Arizona. He's been president of both Western Seminary and Phoenix Seminary and has written a couple of books, including Hit by a Ton of Bricks, You're Not Alone. And you know the ministry, You're Not Alone. You hear him on the broadcast, You're Not Alone. Guys have teamed up to just share some traits, what it means to be Christ-like. And I want to, pick up on that. Guys, let's talk about, we all want to be Christ-like, but what does that look like in terms of friendship? Somehow, when I read the Gospels, you read about Jesus' interaction with his 12 disciples, but maybe we don't know. Were they really good friends? And are there things that we can draw from the Gospel accounts that give us some insight into how Jesus wants us to be friends?
Well, Neil, we were talking about Christ washing his disciples' feet, and one of the things we try to do in this book is provide practical applications. And one of the purposes of the book is for a men's group in a church could use it as a way to explore and develop relationships. But as a pragmatic example, my brother Bond, when he went into the Air Force in boot camp, he was put in charge of keeping the barracks clean. And, power in terms of leadership really can be top down or bottom up, but if you're going to keep those barracks clean, you can't do it by yourself. And when everyone left for the weekend, he, in a Christ servant leadership type style, he stayed there that weekend and got that place immaculate so it could pass inspection. And this would be my metaphor for washing the feet. And then when everyone came back, they were amazed with it. He said, "Guys, it's clean. Can you help me keep it that way?" And so that's kind of an application of what you can learn from Christ's example that we can apply in our daily lives.
Yes, and Neil, I want to add to that. One of the things that Jim and I wrestled with is that we talked about, could we in the book say Jesus was one of the guys, quote unquote, one of the guys, and we decided no, we could not say that because his lordship was always there. He was the Son of God, is the Son of God. And so we called him the guy. However, when I talk about Jim being a friend or he talks about me, we would say the guys were together. But specifically to your question, we would say we can learn from Jesus as it relates to friendship. And I like the fact that Jim talks a lot about servanthood because I think there are lots of relationships in our country, in the church, among men, where we call each other friend, but we're really not because we just do stuff together, but guys really don't serve one another. So Jim and I are trying to say, based on how Jesus served his friends and his followers and his disciples, as we think about being friends, we need to say, how can I serve my friend? What can I do to help my friend become a better person? That might be poking him in the eye, or as Jim said earlier so eloquently, saying to a friend, what you're doing really, it is not Christ-like. It's not just doing something that the person wants to have done for them.
We're talking. By the way, go ahead, Jim.
I think the nice part is that we, in the book, we draw from the examples of Christ. Take something like intimacy, which is a real challenge for a lot of men to really open up and share. And intimacy is just about being able to think out loud in front of a friend and be comfortable with it. And, you know, we can look at the example Christ gave when he went to the garden. He took his friends with him, and he prayed a very agonizing, open prayer in earshot of his friends, and we know that because they documented it for us in the gospel. And, you know, Christ clearly was not lacking any issues of being macho, but he had no problem being very transparent and open about something that a lot of men would try to conceal. So if we can see that example from Christ, why should we be reluctant to be open with our friends when we're in pain or fearful or troubled or going through a difficult time and look to them for some guidance and support?
I was thinking about that verse, I think it's in Proverbs, isn't it? About a friend born for time of adversity. You know, that it's probably in the hard times when friendship is really it's really refined. I guess we see what we're made of, right?
Yeah, it's easy to be a fair weather friend. It's that person that'll be there for you at 3 o'clock in the morning, when you've got a crisis. Sure.
John, talk about maybe just from your experience. You and Susan discovered a family member involved becoming addicted to drugs. I mean, that must have been a pretty devastating time. What was the role of friends in your life at that point?
Yeah, well, the words "pretty devastating" don't get to the depth of the pain we felt. And it's very interesting that the first person I called was my brother, who's one of my very best friends. Second person I called was a college friend who's from Oregon, whose son had become addicted to drugs at a Christian high school in Portland. And what I found out is that, and I talk about this in the book, is that a friend did not necessarily have to have had a child on drugs to be helpful to me. There were some who showed great compassion. Some of them put their arm around my shoulder. They would say, "I don't know what you're feeling. I haven't had a kid on drugs, but I want you to know that I care, and I want you to know I can rely on you." There were some other friends with whom I'm not so close now. They didn't seem to want to give compassion or to say, "What can I do to help?" They wanted to try to pry to figure out, had Susan and I been bad parents, or had we taken our kids to church enough? Well, good night. I was a pastor. Our kids had to be there, whether they wanted to be there or not. Wanted to know if we had discussed the Bible enough with our kids. And I came to realize that the genuine friends didn't want to dig into my life to find out what happened. They wanted to come close to me, to put their arm around me, either literally or figuratively, to say, "What can I do to help you?" And consequently, I've moved closer to some friends, and I've moved away from some people who I thought were friends because they didn't seem to care. They just wanted to analyze and somehow criticize.
And you talk about it, and I think you in terms of the traits, we've talked humility and honesty, respect, intimacy. You talk about support as well. So why is it so hard to ask for help, though? I mean, John, you took a step by calling some people, but you gave the golf example. I mean, there's people that would go for 3 years without asking for help.
Well, that's true, Neil, and we, that is, you're not alone, asked and hired the Barna Research Institute to do research with pastors as it relates to their kids on drugs. And what we found out through their research is that 17% of the pastors in our country have kids who have abused drugs or are abusing drugs. But sadly, only 27% of that 17% have gone for help. So that means that 73% of the pastors in our country who've had problems with their kids on drugs haven't gone for help, which is just mind-boggling. You know, if the kid broke his leg or has a toothache, they would go to the doctor, but somehow it's back to that thing we talked about early in the program. Men have a hard time saying, "I'm in trouble." Drug counselors to whom I've told those statistics say they don't believe them. They think that they're even higher. When I say, what do you mean? They say, you pastors are the best liars we know. You don't tell the truth if in any way it's going to reveal a weakness or a need in your family. So I think, again, it's part of that culture, back to my being an idiot in Spokane, telling that little kid, big kids don't cry, instead of comforting him. And so our culture has sort of taught us not to tell the truth. And yet Jesus was a truth teller. John said Jesus was full of grace and truth.
I want to talk a little bit more about truth and about trusting and teaching and continue on with our discussion. By the way, I just want to mention, you can join the broadcast. We've got four copies of John and Jim's book to give away, Achieving High Performance Friendship. It's a book for men. If you have a comment, a question, like to join the broadcast, you can do that. You can call us at 877-93-FAITH. 877-933-2484, or you can go email as well, which maybe is more convenient for you or easy. And, of course, guys don't like the, you know, you can be detached. It's perfect. You can go on our website, faithradionet.com, faithradionet.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page, and there's an email link there, and I'd love to have you just join the broadcast that way and share your question, your comment. Let's take a short break and come back. I want to talk about, Irwin had a question about commenting on Proverbs 27:17, that when, I don't know, about iron sharpening iron. We'll get the guy's response to that here in just a moment as we continue on talking about achieving high-performance friendship here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Thanks for tuning in today. My guests, Dr. John Vodder, Dr. James Weatherby, they've co-written a book called Achieving High Performance Friendship, a book for men, and it is published by Mead Publishing. Got some copies available if you'd like to join the broadcast. Irwin checked in called in just a minute ago on the phone, and wants to get some reaction to Proverbs 27:17. Familiar words, as iron sharpens iron, a friend sharpens a friend. What does that teach us about the importance of friendship?
Well, I think it's exactly what Jim said earlier. In high-performance friendships, that doesn't mean that we always go to a friend when we're in trouble, but genuine friends tell each other the truth. Genuine friends tell each other when they're doing something wrong, how they need to grow and how they need to improve. And consequently, he said, you know, both he, Jim, and I have challenged each other from time to time to say, think you're doing this wrong, think your attitude's wrong, think you need to change. And I don't think we've ever done it in an acrimonious fashion. We've done it because we trust one another, we love one another, and I know when Jim's talked to me, I know that he has my best interests at heart, and that's why he's talking to me. In fact, that's one of the things that took our relationship farther. When I was still at Wayzata Free Church, he called me one day, and we talked about whatever it was for which he called me. And then he said, by the way, may I tell you something about how your office is run? And I said, yes. He said, when I called the church, I asked for you. The receptionist said, I'll put you through. And instead of getting you, I got your secretary. And he said, I thought I was going to get you. He said, so really the receptionist should say, I will put you through to his secretary. Well, just that little comment, I realized he took a risk because he didn't know if I would respond or turn him off. But I saw that as something I needed to know about how the office was being run, how something we needed to know. And he cared enough to take the risk to tell me the truth. And that took the relationship the next step, because he told me the truth.
Well, universities are known for bureaucracy. I just didn't think John wanted his church to appear bureaucratic to get to talk to the pastor. But a similar story when in John's dealing with a child on drugs. I was so impressed because, you know, we've often hear that it's not what happens, it's how you respond to it. And John's response just amazed me, that he developed a ministry to help parents who's had children on drugs, you're not alone, so that people could get counsel and advice. And I just thought it was an incredibly Christ-like response. And one day I was complimenting him on it, and I said something that I meant to be positive, but it wasn't. And what I said was, well, you never know. Maybe this happened so that you could provide this ministry. And John very firmly but very kindly said, I hope Christ wouldn't allow one of my children to get on drugs so that I could start a ministry. And I realized how foolish what I had just said was, but it was a very kind reprimand so that I would not make that kind of mistake again in a conversation which was intended to be supportive, but it was just not the right way to express it.
One of the couple of the traits you talk about is trusting and teaching, and I was interested to know if that's more about mentorship than friendship. And Dan, calling in from St. Paul, has that question. Dan, go ahead. You're on with Jim and John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you are finding a gap in mentorship from older men of faith for younger men of faith. I, as I've gone through different seasons of life, and have talked to men on and off about how to address certain things that come up in different seasons of life, it surprises me that there's not more of that guidance provided. The knowledge is out there, the faith knowledge is out there. I just wonder if you're also doing that where there's not those mechanisms in place to provide that guidance. And is that part of the high achievement approach?
Yeah. Good question, Dan. Is high achieving performance, high performance, is that mentoring? Is that a key part of it?
Well, it is, but I think Paul said wrote something 2,000 years ago that is probably more, or let me restate that, the Spirit of God motivated the Apostle Paul to write something 2,000 years ago that's more relevant to our society than we can possibly imagine, and that is that he said to younger men, treat an older man as you would your father, and then he said to the older men, and do not look down on youthful men, or he said to Timothy, don't let anyone look down on your youth. So he was saying both to older men and younger men, and I would call myself an older man now as a 67-year-old, that we need to respect people regardless of how old they are. And I don't know what it's like in Minnesota because I only visit there now, but I often walk into stores here in Arizona and will have guys young enough to be my grandson call me Bud. Hey, Bud, welcome to my store, which I take it as a sign of disrespect. But something that I've learned from Jim, because I tend to be more direct and Jim tends to ask questions more, is that I've started saying to younger men, Would you like a compliment from someone old enough to be your father? Would you mind if someone old enough to be your father made a comment on what you just said? And so what I'm saying in response, Dan, is that I think our culture, somehow younger men are not respecting older men, but that those of us who've been around for a while can't react to that and be angry, but when we can, to yes, mentor, even if it's just a brief comment, because we do have experience. On the other hand, we do say in the book, and this was actually something that I heard one time on television, I don't even know who said it, that the sin of young men is passion, the sin of middle-aged men is pride, and the sin of older men is prejudice. And so I'm afraid that too many men who are calling themselves seniors now just want to sit around and complain about the younger generation instead of realizing that there are a lot of young men who have been raised in one-parent families and desperately want a man in their life, an older man, who can give them some guidance. So I think it's the responsibility of those of us who are the older men to step forward and offer that advice, but offer it in a palatable way.
Well, Jim, we're going to take another call. Marcus is waiting. We're going to get to that in a moment. But is helping someone improve, is that an expectation of friendship? I mean, is that... when you are in relationship with John, is that you're expecting that?
If it's a high-performance friendship, that would be one of the litmus tests. If I'm not becoming a better person because of the friendship, either by the example that he sets or by the feedback, you know, not getting feedbacks like hitting golf balls in the dark, you're not going to, you know what's happening. If someone doesn't occasionally encourage you in the areas where you're doing well and also suggesting areas where you could do better.
Okay. Let's go to Marcus. Marcus calling in from Apple Valley. Questions about younger generation. You're on with John and Jim. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Thanks, you guys, for talking about such an important subject that brings forth authentic relationships. I'm curious as to, I'm 55 years old, and I'm just curious as to if you see our younger generation who seem to cry out for authentic relationships, do you believe that the younger generation are more apt to have these intimate, real relationships easier and more likely than the older generation? I just find that so many times that you have to do, at least in my generation, you have to do these activities with guys, you know, and when it comes to talk, it's that whole thing about being versus doing. It's a tougher thing for older guys, not for myself, but for other guys that I often encounter.
Okay. What do you think, guys?
Well, you know, it's interesting. As part of our research for the book, we came across another book written by Kimmel. Guyland is the name of it, just one word, Guyland. And he points out that today the average young man is evolving through what's called a buddy culture. They're kind of postponing adulthood, unfazed by the demands of parents, girlfriends, jobs. They don't have children. They are getting married 5-10 years later. They don't have children until 5-10 years later. So they don't get the nuisances of adult life. And they, you know, they can kind of live in a culture that involves, you know, getting through college, hanging out, partying, watching TV, spending a lot of time with tech toys, and postponing starting that. So there's actually some evidence that, you know, kids will make friends quickly, but they're not really deep, open friendships. They get all the peer pressure that can certainly result in bad decisions, but. It's an area that we hope to address with this book to kind of encourage kids. John, could you talk to what your experience when you talked before the Oregon-Stanford game I thought was kind of relevant to this discussion?
Yeah, Neil, a few weeks ago I was privileged to be up in Oregon before Stanford's football team played Oregon State and spoke to the Stanford Chapel. And I spoke on friendship, and I said that there are we use the term friend a lot, but Jim and I talk about five levels of friendship, and the fifth level or the lowest level is when we just know each other. When they say that's my friend, but if you said, well, tell me about the man, I wouldn't know anything about him. The next level is we do things together, and then the third level is we like one another, but we still don't dig into one another's lives. And the second level is when we really do know one another, and that relates to Christians or non-Christians, but we say the highest level of relationship and friendship can only happen among Christians, because then we challenge one another to grow in relationships. And these guys were preparing for a game. You could tell the moment there were two coaches there, but you could tell when they walked in the room, they didn't want a lot of extraneous talk. They wanted to listen to the 25-minute talk that I had prepared, was asked to give, and as soon as the meeting was over, they left. About half of them came up and shook my hand and left. But what was interesting is that I've gotten a number of emails from the chaplain of the team who told me that guys came to him later and said they appreciated what I said about friendship. And so part of my answer to the question is I think it's just given to us by God himself that that we are to have friends, that God created us to be social animals. The Bible talks about the fact that the body of Christ is a family, that gifted people, spiritual gifts have been given because we cannot be islands. We must rely on one another. And that the younger generation doesn't always see that in us. It's what Irwin said, that there are a lot of men who do things together, but we don't relate to one another and we don't share our lives. And I think when we do that as older people, the younger generation sees that and they're attracted by it. I try as much as I can when I'm a guest speaker somewhere to say, I have been married to Susan for 44 years. And, you know, some people will approach me as though I'm a dinosaur or something because they don't know anybody that's been married that long. And I'll have younger people, younger men or women say to me, my goodness, how have you stayed together that long? Because I think intrinsically God has put knowledge of himself in our hearts, and people know that's the way to live, even though they don't see it as often as they should in our society.
Let me, our time is getting away from us, and we don't really have time to close up properly, but I want to thank my guests, Dr. John Vodder and Dr. Jim Weatherby. They've co-written a book called Achieving High Performance Friendship, a Book for Men. Let me just run through the categories, the key traits of choosing friends wisely: humility and honesty, respect, intimacy, support, trust, love and loyalty, independence, and kindness and encouragement, and eternal values. And I hope that you will go to the website in the Connecting Faith at faithradionet.com and listen to the podcast. Pass it on to a friend. Guys, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil.